As these couple of weeks have gone along, maybe your perspective on what it means to be rich or to live richly has been affected in some way. I know it has mine. I know it's easy to say, for example, that I'm not rich when I compare myself to Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Warren Buffett, those guys like that. I say, man, certainly I'm not rich compared to people like that. Most of us can find somebody who has more than us or somebody who has a lot more than us. But we don't have to go to some of the richest people in the world. We can look at the neighborhood on the other side of us, perhaps, and we can see somebody that has more than us, a bigger house, or maybe they have two houses and more cars. Maybe they make $500,000 a year, and I don't make that much money. But the fact is, when people are asked if they are rich, studies have shown that they say they are not, but somebody who makes twice as much of them is rich. And so if you make $35,000, you say, no, I'm not rich. And then they're asked, what is rich? And then they say, well, somebody that makes about $70,000. And then those who make $70,000 ask if they're rich. They say they're not. What would be rich to you? And then they would say, well, somebody making about $150,000. And so the bottom line with that is, for a lot of us, we don't want to admit that we're rich, but we know somebody who is. But the fact is, that when it comes to men like that, I mean, who are filthy, ugly, rich, I mean, who can basically, when it comes to their money, just do anything they want to do with it, I believe, and this is not a wild, crazy, far-out statement, I believe that my quality of life is closer to them than most of the people in the world. And granted, you know, I can't just go to my bank account or my checkbook and write a check and go to MD Anderson or go to Mayo Clinic and not even give a thought about it like somebody like that can. But when it comes to having enough food and having shelter and having clothing and having my needs met, and living in a country where, while the healthcare system is not perfect, we still have a great, excellent healthcare system, and the standard of living in terms of quality of life, in terms of lifespan, and in terms of not having to worry about whether I'm going to have a meal or not, obviously, there are many, many more people in the world who are worrying about things like that, not just for them, but for us as well. And I've mentioned as well that a lot of the things that we complain about or gripe about are things that we might feel comfortable talking to each other. We've had a bad month at our house with the car and the house, and I'm not going to go into the details about the sump pump or how a $200 car repair became an $800 car repair, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I might talk to you about that, but you place me in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and set me down with some of those people in Port-au-Prince, and they asked me, Grady, tell me about some of your problems this week. And I said, well, let me tell you about my sump pump, and let me tell you what happened to my house, and I had to spend this much to do this work on my car. I think we get the idea. And so our quality of life, even if you're not willing to admit that you're rich, but my feeling is that most of us are. But if you still insist that you're not, and you may not be, don't wait till you're rich, whatever that magical spot or number is for you. Don't wait till you're there to start living richly. And to follow the instructions that Paul gives us in 1 Timothy and all the things that Jesus said about how we live, because it's important to understand that if that time comes when you do become rich, you want to know how to live that way. And I think a good time and a place to start is not somewhere at a distant time, but to start now thinking about that. The fact that whenever that time comes, if it comes for somebody else, that I want to remember that ultimately it's not about what I have, but it's about what I do with what I have. Because there is a gravitational pull that is so abundantly clear, not just from reading what Jesus has to say or Paul, but just in everyday real life, why Paul has to say to those who are rich in the things of this world, not to be arrogant and not to put their hope in riches which are so uncertain, because there are negative side effects that can pull us away from God, that can focus our minds and our hearts more on our things, more on our money, more what we're making, more on what we're spending, and somehow have the attitude that we can save our way or hoard our way or spend our way to safety and security. And we can't do it. And so to pre-think about these things, when I'm first starting out, or when I'm even younger than that, if I can, depending on my circumstance, it's smart to have a plan. To have a saving plan, to have a spending plan, to have a financial security plan that ultimately is not in money and things, but ultimately is in God. And that's where we need to be. That's where I need to be. Because our hope can shift and move away from God and toward things as we get more and more and more and seek more and more and more. So I believe it's good to start with a giving plan as well. Saving, spending, giving. And I suggested last week a good baseline goal. As I look at what the Bible teaches, I believe it's reasonable and biblical to shoot for that 10% goal as a place to go to, and even if you're able to go even beyond that in what you give to others, give to the church, give to other organizations that you believe in. And I know that in some ways, some of us, we just kind of recoil at that. And I know if you're a first-time guest this morning, you're thinking, okay, he's trying to manipulate me into giving money. That's not it at all. Because God, more than anything, He wants our hearts. And He knows that our money can be one of the main things. Money can be some of those things that draw us away from relying upon God. And whatever we give, He wants us to do it with the right motives. He doesn't want us to do it by giving only to someone or something or some organization, only because we can get something back, some benefit. I remember the first check I wrote to church back when I was at Lipscomb. And as a poor college student, I would go to church. We went to different places, and I would throw in a buck here or there because I was a poor college kid back in the late 70s and early 80s. And so, you know, to me, that seemed like pretty good. But so I'd never written a check, though. But when I tried out to be youth minister at the Greenbrier Church of Christ in Robertson County, I remember when we went, I was going to teach a class. I'm pretty sure Jeannie came with me. We were dating at the time. Not engaged, but dating. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to write a check. Because, you know, I'm trying out for the job here, and my motives were not all pure. I'm going to tell you that right now. But I thought, you know, if I throw a couple of bucks in the plate, they're not going to know that I gave it. So I'm going to write a check. First check I ever wrote to a church. And so I stepped it up, wrote a check for $5, put it in the collection plate. So those that count the money, hey, this he tried out. He gave us $5. No kidding. I get a call that week. I think I may have told you this story a long time ago. But I get a call from a nice man, a great man. He was the treasurer of the church, was a dentist there in Greenbrier, actually worked on my T-Sum and did it for free. He calls me up. Larry Nixon was his name. And he says, Grady, I hate to tell you this, but your check bounced. I am not making that up. So maybe that was God's way of telling me, not only make sure you have enough money in your checking account before you write a $5 check, but maybe you need to think about the reasons why you give what you give. And Jesus said, if we are faithful in little things, we're going to be faithful in much. And so we need to think about these things, whether it's a little or whether it's a whole lot, because these things matter. They make a difference. And so in this story in Luke chapter 12, Jesus talks about something that Paul talks about as well in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Remember, when Paul gives these instructions to Timothy, he begins by saying this: instruct those who are rich in this present world. And there is an implication there, and not just an implication, but just an outright statement in verse 19, that there is another world, that there is another realm, that there is something beyond this life. In fact, if you do a survey of most people in the United States, and I'm sure around the world, most would say they believe in some kind of afterlife. I was actually looking at some statistics from the Pew Research Center done among 16 countries, and 80% of the people in those countries believe in some kind of heaven or hell. Now, their ideas about exactly what that may be like might be different, but they believe in an afterlife. And in the United States, 72% of people believe in the concept of heaven, 58% in the concept of hell. And once again, they might define those things a little bit differently, but whatever the case is, they believe, many people believe, there's something beyond, that when you die, it's not just it's all over. And so Stanley, in one of his videos, asked the question, what makes you feel more uncomfortable or uneasy? What makes you more nervous? Which of these two comments or statements would make you the most nervous or worried? Number one, there is no God. Or number two, you have no money. Zero. Whatever you have, you're back down to square one. Which of those would scare you the most right now? And I know most of us are probably thinking and perhaps feeling maybe a little bit smug about, of course, the one that would bring the most fear to me is the idea, the concept, is that there's no God, there's nothing. That matter is all that there is. There's no spiritual realm, there's no supernatural realm, nothing beyond this life. But however somebody might respond to that question, the closer they get to the end, and when that reality really is staring at them, us, you, me, in the face, you know what we're thinking about. And you know what concerns us more. And even if we claim we don't believe in God or heaven or hell or the afterlife or the supernatural, we're probably thinking about it a lot more when we're confronted with the reality of the brevity in the end of life. Am I right about that or wrong? It's the truth. And so if we believe in God and we believe there's an afterlife, and if we believe what Paul says and what Jesus says about money and its bearing on our lives, not only right now, but in being connected to eternity in some way, then maybe we need to think about the importance of not allowing things and possessions to hold such a tight grip on us that we are being held and gripped by what we have, what we earn, what we save, more than being gripped by the heart and the love and the life of God. And as that great rock band who sang one of the greatest old rock songs back in the 70s and early 80s, 38 Special, said, "Sometimes we have to hold on loosely." And the song says, if you're hearing that song in your mind right now, I wish I was singing it for you, but I'm not. They say, don't let go. Hold on loosely. Okay, I'm singing, I shouldn't. And don't let go. If you hold on too tightly, you're going to lose control. And if we hold on too tightly, we can lose control too. And that's part of the lesson that is found in this story of this rich man in Luke chapter 12. Jesus tells this story because somebody's having an argument about an inheritance. Wow, that never happens today, does it, anymore? You never hear about that. I mean, life doesn't change much, does it? I know of a lot of situations with a lot of families when whoever that relative is passes away and the inheritance and the will and all that comes up. I tell you what, I've seen people fighting tooth and toenail. I've seen families splitting apart because of issues like that. And I know a lot of times they'll say, it's not about the money. But a lot of times it is about the money. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it is. And so a brother says to Jesus, tell my brother to split the right portion of the family inheritance with me. And Jesus says, I'm not going to get involved in your squabble. Jesus says, I'm not going to get down in the weeds in this squabble you're having with your family member about money. But Jesus did see this as an opportunity to teach a very important lesson as he tells a story, a parable. It's a story that he makes up to make a point. And so Jesus would tell these stories to draw people in. And then many times as he's making the point that he wants to make about what he's talking about, Jesus will bring on what I call the shock factor. And people are moving in a certain direction, and then he totally blows them away with something that they're not expecting. And so that's the story he tells of a man who was rich, who had a lot of things. He worked hard. He was mega successful. He had so much, he didn't know what to do with it. He had so much, he had to store it and worked harder and got more and had bigger barns. And in that culture, in that mindset of that day, folks automatically equated this idea of having a lot and being rich with being approved of by God and being blessed by God. So as everybody's listening to this story told by Jesus, they're probably thinking, man, this guy he's resourceful, he's smart. On top of that, he's blessed by God, because why would he have all of this stuff unless God was with him? And this is a great lesson. If we just stop right there, you know, a lot of us would think, hey, this is a good lesson on resourcefulness and saving. We want our kids, our grandkids, we want them to learn and understand the importance of saving for a rainy day and thinking ahead and planning ahead. And there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself, obviously. But that's not where Jesus goes. So, boom, Jesus absolutely throws them a curveball when God says to him, you fool, this night your soul is required from you, and who's going to have what you have now? And they're probably thinking, as they are in shock and they're looking at one another, how can this be? He ran out of life before he ran out of money. He had so much. He had so much to live for. He had so much security. But his opportunity was gone. He ran out of time. and he wasn't going to take it with him, was he? Once again, going back to that passage, 1 Timothy 6, we read this a couple of weeks ago, but godliness with contentment is great gain. We brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into a temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. The truth is, when we go, we all leave the same thing, and that's everything. We leave it all. 100%. So don't let that picture fool you. I don't know if that was staged. I don't know where the saying originated from, but it's an important point for us to understand. You may see a hearse pulling a U-Haul, but the truth is, you can't take it with you. And so, what we do with it now, with mammon, with things, with money, we listen to the words of Jesus when he makes the application and says, so this is how it will be with anyone who spends their life storing up things for themselves and is not rich toward God. And God doesn't need your money. God doesn't need my money. God is going to be fine without our money. But in a sense, however we give it, in what context, whether we're talking church or another organization or helping your neighbor down the street or some spontaneous need, we're giving that in the name of God to honor God and also to keep our minds focused on Him, because when we do that, when we give, when we share, and when it isn't just leftovers and it's a part of our plan, it's a reminder to us from whom all of it came. And we understand that what we have is not just for our consumption or our saving or our interests. But to the rich man in this story, that's what it represented. It represented security. It represented pleasure. It represented him coming to a point in his life where he was guarded against all negative eventualities and he could just enjoy what he has. And so Jesus continues to teach here. I'm not going to read all the verses, but Jesus says that God's going to take care of you. Don't worry about your life, what you'll eat, what you'll drink, what you'll put on. The pagan world runs after all these things. They're preoccupied with that. God's going to take care of you. Now, he doesn't say God's going to give you everything you want or whatever need or that you're going to be filthy rich. But he does say God's going to take care of you. And it's in the context of telling this story that Jesus says that. The flowers of the field, they're beautiful. God clothes them. He's going to clothe you. He's going to provide for you. He provides for the birds. And then once again, coming down to the end of that section, as Jesus teaches, he says this. Don't be afraid, little flock. This is verse 32 of Luke chapter 12. Don't be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted. Now, Jesus there is not talking about this idea of us buying salvation or doing enough good deeds or sharing enough that we can cross that heaven line or doing what we do like some mercenaries that we do something or we do good or we give because we get something good. And listen, I'm going to help you with your need. Let me just tell you, whatever your need is, I'll give you this and I do these things because I want to go to heaven. I don't do enough, give enough. They'll get me into heaven. If that's how any of us see this, it's totally wrong. The motive of why we give, what we give, whatever it is important. but making that generosity in whatever the context is a priority is a way for us to be reminded that it is not mine, and I don't want to put my trust in those things, that my treasure is in heaven and not upon this earth. And so then right after that, that's when Jesus himself says, for where your treasure is, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. What you value the most, what preoccupies your time, your mind, your heart, your focus, your source of security, that's most important. That's your treasure. That's where your heart is. And so why does Jesus spend so much time talking about money and things, the rich man and Lazarus, Matthew 25, the judgment scene with the sheep and the goats? I could go on and on and on. It's because Jesus, Paul, God, all they want us to understand that if we're rich, that we want to be good at being rich. That we want to do good. That we want to be rich in good deeds. That we want to be generous. And that we want to share. That we want to plan. That we want to have an awareness. That we don't want to just give leftovers. That we want to give first fruits. And that we don't want to get rich until we start thinking about these things, because most of us will never start, because most of us don't want to admit that we're rich. Don't put your hope in uncertain riches, and don't be arrogant, but put your hope in God, who richly supplies you, me, us, with all good things to enjoy. And so it may mean for some that you'll be Jeff Bezos rich. For most of us, not. But neither does it mean that we have to take a vow of poverty. That with our time, our talents, our resources, our money, we want to be moved by God and what He's done for us and what we share with others, so that when I'm asked the personal question, does God have my heart, that I can say, yes, God, you have my heart. And not just 10% of me, or whatever percent you're talking about. God wants all of us. And as we live richly in all these ways, God's going to bless us beyond what we could imagine. I'm going to close with this verse before Sean shares some thoughts with us. Jesus says, what does it profit a man if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what will a person give in exchange for his soul? But that same Jesus says, in life with me, I've come to give you life, and that you might have it abundantly.